myself, I missed some of the talks, but now I'm trying to see all of them. And this is work I did with Sergei Klemnikov and Georgios Michalos Georgakis from Purdue University. It was edited last year. And so some of you might have heard this talk, or at least some similar talk, so I apologize for that, although you probably don't remember what I said anyway. But and also, as a way, this was supposed to motivate discussions and everything, so even if it's a bit older, it should be okay. So to summarize, first I'm going to give an introduction. I'm going to discuss shockwaves from the point of view of just a lambda one Lifshitz, so these shockwaves in fluids and also in relativistic settings. And I'm going to briefly discuss the string gauge theory duality and how that allows us to study fluids. And I think this is more for the people that don't work in ADS-CFT. Hopefully that will be useful. And then I'm going to discuss how one can discuss these shockwaves in the fluid in terms of ADS-CFT. And they should have a dual description in terms of gravity. And they will correspond to some waves propagating on the horizon. And that will be the main topic of this talk. And I'm going to discuss other results. So I'm going to concentrate in N=4 in 3+1 dimensions. And then I'm going to discuss briefly what happens in other dimensions and some comments about gravity and some oscillations of the shockwave produce sound. And I'm going to discuss that also and some comments if I have time. So what are shockwaves? And as I said, this is in lambda, well, in any textbook on fluid mechanics. In particular, you can see it in lambda and Lifshitz. So a shock wave is a perturbation that propagates supersonically in a fluid. And to see that those have to exist, we can take an arbitrary object, let's say round like this. And instead of moving it supersonically, we can keep it there and send a supersonic fluid moving towards the object. And suppose this point here, if this point produces a perturbation, if the perturbation were to move at the speed of sound, or less, it will be carried by this fluid, and it will be inside the cone here, and so it will be completely inside the object. So it's, this thing will have to modify the motion of the fluid in a way that, seen from the fluid at rest, moves supersonically. Because now that doesn't have to be true if this is pointy. So if this is a sharp point here, it can create a cone like this, which is moving at the speed of sound with respect to the fluid. But a blunt object in a supersonic flow will produce always a shock wave. And the shock wave can be attached or detached, in this case it's detached from the object. If this is kind of more sharper, it could be attached. And there is a region, so in the frame where this guy is at rest, the motion, there is a region here where the motion is subsonic, and here is supersonic. Now the normal velocity to the shock always go from supersonic to subsonic, but since there is another direction here, it turns out that it's like that, and I'm not sure this is completely understood, so this is not part of my talk, but in the sense I'm not going to do anything with gravity, but I'm just trying to describe what shock waves are. And the other thing is that they are characterized by a discontinuity in the hydrodynamic quantity, so there is a jump in the velocity that here go from supersonic to subsonic, for example, and there is a jump in the pressure and in the temperature. And I have here an example that you can download from the web, so I'm not expert on this, and just Google this and you get this example. So this is a picture took by Mach himself, I think, of a bullet moving in a fluid, and is you create put a light like that, and the jump in the pressure creates a different density, and there is a creates a shadow, so it's called shadowography or something like that. So when an airplane moves supersonically, there is several shocks here, and behind the shock there is a region of lower pressure, and in this region you can have condensation, and you can get pictures like that. Also for a rocket you can see like that, and this is a shock wave you can create at home. You just open the faucet and the fluid moves radially, and you will see that there is a jump called the hydraulic jump. Now, I'm not saying that the fluid is moving supersonically here, obviously. What this is, or maybe in your house it is, but but what happens is that there are surface waves on the surface of the fluid. So we know the usual waves from the ocean. So if the fluid moves faster than the speed of a wave, which is what happens here, then you can have a shock in the surface. And that's why the surface has a jump. So if you see, this is thin, and then it gets a jump. And also there's a jump in the height and jump in the velocity. So here it's moving faster than the speed of a wave, and they are slower. Ah, well, yeah, no, this is the idea is that, as I said, this moves from supersonic to subsonic. So the kinetic energy is greatly reduced and is converted into heat. So it dissipates a lot of energy. So apparently, this is from the 60s, the people wanted to see how to come back from space. And if you have a blunt object, you create a shock and you dissipate energy more easily. So that's why the space capsules are kind of blunt instead of being pointy. But okay, as I said, I'm not an expert. But. So, yeah, this is how they thought they should do it, but some guy came up with the idea, if it's blunt, it dissipates more energy and it slows down. Okay, and in plasmas, the example that I'm going to use to, so all these are motivation for what I'm going to do later. I'm not going to study any of these problems with ADS-CFT. Maybe a little bit about this one. But. Okay, so, and this is in RIG. So in RIG, you have a collisions of gold with gold, and two nuclei collide, so a highly relativistic velocity. So they, from because of the boost, they are, look like they call pancakes, they look flat. And they collide against each other, not head-on. They can collide as little off. And inside those, when the plasma forms, sometimes two partons, let's say two quarks, collide in a high-energy collision and create, let's say, two C quarks that move in opposite directions. And let's say they move along the transverse plane, which is where the detectors are. And suppose it occurs very close to the surface. So one quark will just escape, and it will produce some bump in the detector. And the other should go and create a bump at pi from there in the detector here. But to do that, it has to move all through the fluid. And it turns out that instead of seeing a bump, you see two bumps at a certain angle from the pi, from the initial bump here. And one interpretation of that is that this quark that is moving here, it dissipates energy and creates, instead of so slow down, and creates a shock wave. And this shock wave emerges from the plasma and creates these two jets or events here. I think the more recently there is some doubt about that this being correct. So this is just one interpretation. I'm not sure. The other one is next to the surface. So you have to tag this guy with very high transfer momentum. And you see this event, and then you look at what you see on the other side. You could happen if it collides in the middle, but then you, the detector, well, you don't record that event. Yeah.
I think it's only
true, yeah. Yeah, so now I think, yes, I'm not sure what were the new results, but.
What's the alternative? This higher. So they have something called the elliptic flow, which is the first question.
Yeah, so maybe I should show this picture here. Yeah. So that was David is saying. So, okay, maybe let me show you the experimental result. I mean, the experimental result, I think, is okay, but the interpretation is different. So these are the experiments, and they was noticed first this effect in the star collaboration, and then for the Phoenix, and I'm showing this second here. And as David is saying, Shuria gave this explanation, and probably that's why he's still defensive. But
the first author would not defend.
Ah, okay. So. But well, at the beginning I said that the talk is a little bit older, so. Yeah, no, but it's okay. So then the experiment shows like this. So you have this event here, which is the one I was saying, and then 3.1, something like pi, you see the other event. But you see this other event when the centrality, as they say, is, I don't remember if it's high, what they call which are off center. So there is no fluid, so there is plasma only here, and there is no fluid to, for the quark to move through, and that was this pi. And as you increase this, you see that you have two peaks. Now these peaks should move, so they should be always at the angle of the shock. So this is seems wrong here, that the peak is sort of moving. Maybe that's one of the problems. But at that time, they told me that these peaks depend on, I mean, these are tiny. They look big, but they are tiny, so they are have to subtract some background, and depending how you subtract the background, you get the peaks at the same point or a different point. So. But okay, and in ADS-CFT, this was discussed by Gapser, Pufu, Yaromi, Chalo-Georgakis, and Fries at Princeton, and Chesley and Jaffe at Washington, and so there was some work trying to understand this. So, but as I said, I mean, the shock waves exist, obviously. If they see them at Rick or not, okay, that's another question. And as I said, this is just a motivation for what I'm going to do, because I'm not going to say anything anyway about Rick. Okay, so what are the shock waves? Let me describe a little bit more precisely. So you can, if a shock is propagating supersonically, locally you can consider it to be flat, and you can move with the same speed. So you can think of a flat shock at rest. And the supersonic motion becomes subsonic, the kinetic energy becomes heat, as I said, so they create a lot of entropy, even in ideal hydrodynamics. You could have the equations of motion of ideal hydro accept other solution, where subsonic becomes supersonic, but that will violate the second law of thermodynamics, so this couldn't exist, shouldn't exist. And if you include viscosity, this solution disappears, because that violates time reverse, and this is the only solution that you find. And so the discontinuity means that the hydrodynamic description breaks down at the shock, so the derivative should be small, and obviously they are not, because you have a jump. And that means that if you want to understand what happens at the shock, you need to use some microscopic description. For example, a Boltzmann equation, if it's air or some dilute gas that is having this shock. Now, in the ADS-CFT, the N equals 4 plasma has a hydrodynamic scale, which is 1 over the temperature. And for then you have to go to a theory that is valid at length scales, which are smaller than this. But the dual gravity description is valid up to, I don't know, string scale, which is unrelated to this. So this is gravity would be a microscopic description in the case of plasma. And so I think that's interesting in the sense that at least talking with people that work in this find interesting that one has a different type of hydrodynamic description, microscopic description, and then the corresponding hydrodynamics can be different. So one can see the resolution of the hydrodynamics can be different, and one can compare what happens in different microscopic descriptions. So, and it's, okay, there are other microscopic descriptions, but not the gravity is obviously very different from any others that have been discussed. So I guess I'm not going to say very much about the ADS-CFT, so I'm going to consider the N equals 4 super Young Mills case, which is dual to string theory in ADS-5 cross S5 in the large end limit, so I only have the Toft coupling, and I'm going to consider the case where lambda is large, so the string theory description is good. And I'm going to be interested in how to use this for a description of plasma. So the theory lives in a 3+1 dimension, which is here in the gravity description will be the boundary. And in the gravity description, we have a fifth dimensional theory plus the S5, which doesn't play any role. The fifth dimension is this Z, and Z equals 1 over T. Here is the horizon. So for T going to infinity, the horizon goes to the boundary. And this, you can think of it very small, because hydrodynamics are for wavelengths here, which are much larger than 1 over T. So are these wavelengths which sort of don't see very much this distance here. And that's what hydrodynamics describes. And OK, and you can have all kinds of excitations, but it doesn't really matter. But the only thing I'm going to consider is the gravitons. It will be like zero size strings. Okay, so how do we describe the N equals 4 plasma, the hydrodynamics of the plasma? So we describe it in terms of the energy momentum tensor. And we want to see if you have this plasma, what are the low energy excitations? And one can see the low energy excitations correspond to variations in temperature and motion of the fluid. However, it's not completely obvious how to define the velocity and the temperature. There is some arbitrariness, and there is a particular definition called the Landau frame, which is as follows. So the energy momentum tensor, the symmetric matrix, has an eigenvector with negative eigenvalue. If the fluid is at rest, that's just the time-like direction. If not, you define this to be the forward velocity of the fluid. So u squared is minus 1. And the eigenvalue, you define it to be the temperature to the force up to some coefficient, which is not the usual normalization in fluid in gauge theory. It's just the normalization that is using gravity. So this is the definition of temperature and velocity given the energy momentum tensor, the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor. Now, the energy momentum tensor is a symmetric tensor, traceless 4x4, so it has 9 components. And here I only have 4. So I have 3 for the 4 velocity because u squared is 1 minus 1 and t. So I cannot describe completely the dynamics like this. I need some equations that tell me the other components. So then how the 9 components of t are written in terms of this single eigenvector u. And this is the purpose of hydrodynamics. So hydrodynamics has to give you a way to write t mu nu in terms of these 4 quantities. And then if you apply the conservation equation, it gives you an 4 equations for 4 variables, and you can compute some evolution. But first you need this hydrodynamics. So how does it work in the, and that you have to derive from the microscopic theory. So the microscopic theory will tell you how a fluid that moves with certain velocity and certain temperature was the complete energy momentum tensor. Now in this case, that's gravity. As I was saying, the microscopic decision is given by gravity, and there is a very nice and important paper by Bhattacharya, Hubeni, Mingwal, and Rangamani where they answer precisely this question. So let me review this in slight detail. So what they argue, well, first, if you are not familiar with ADS-CFT, what you have to do is you have a metric in the bulk, and you have to look at the asymptotic value, how that the metric approaches the asymptotic ADS. And this correction, so the metric asymptotically very far away, will be ADS close to the boundary plus some correction. And this correction essentially gives you some way the energy momentum tensor. So for each metric, you can compute the energy momentum tensor. And you can show that vice versa. If you have an energy momentum tensor, you can always find a metric which asymptotically corresponds to that energy momentum tensor. But generically, that metric is singular. And what this author show is that you can system if the metric is such that it has very small derivatives. So as I was saying, the variation here along this direction are much more, the wavelengths are much larger than this, 1 over t. Then one can systematically construct the t mu nu that give rise to a non-singular metric. And those t mu nu's are precisely given by 4 quantities. So the components of the 4 velocity and the temperature. And this is the result. I'm going to describe a little bit better later how it was obtained by them, which is, the again, up to some normalization, which is unconventional in fluid mechanics, is the ideal fluid plus some viscosity term. And this viscosity term was originally derived by Policastro's son and Stalinates in a very famous result that started more or less all these ideas. And then in their paper, they derived the next correction with some specific coefficients and some specific tensors, which doesn't matter here. So we use them in our calculation, but for the talk, it's not really important. And just can all be written in terms of u. And this has one derivative. And those have 2 derivatives. And they provide some expressions that we use. But OK, they are not that complicated. And they can be used for some calculation. So let me, instead of showing those expressions too much, how they derive that. So the derivation was to consider first a fluid moving with constant velocity or uniform velocity and uniform temperature. And that just corresponds to a boosted black hole, which in some coordinates, which are called Eddington-Finkelstein infalling coordinates, have this form. And this B is related to the temperature. And this U is the 4 velocity. So, and beta is like a rapidity. And then they said, OK, suppose that these guys, B, the temperature, and the U depend on the position. So a small approximation, if the derivatives are small, will be just to put the velocity and the temperature depending on the position. And the metric will be just the same metric with this position dependent plus some corrections, where this epsilon is some parameter that characterize the smallness, if you wish, of the derivative. You have to expand the velocity also and the temperature in this epsilon. So this will be constant plus some variation and things like that. And you need to choose some coordinates, and one can choose the coordinates in this way. So this is just a way to choose the coordinates of this metric. And if you do that and you plug this into the Einstein equations, you get that at order n, the Gn will appear multiplied by epsilon to the n. And so it will be linear in G to the n. So the order n will be linear in G to the n. It will be apply some linear operator that depends only on G naught, the zero order approximation, but not on its derivatives, because the derivative will introduce another epsilon. So this operator applied to the Gn will be equal to some source that depends on all the other previous orders. But this equation is always the same. So the thing that changes is the source. So, and this is the metric that we already have, is the boosted black hole. So one can see that this is a linear differential equation that has solutions, linear independent solutions, and one can choose a solution which is normalizable at infinity, which is, you need that from ADS-CFT, and you can see that if you choose this, you can have a solution which is singular or non-singular at the horizon, and you should, well, I know it won't be the horizon, but at the previous horizon, and you choose the one which is non-singular, and you do that order by order, because as I said, this linear operator is always the same. So in that sense, you show that there is always a metric which is non-singular and can be constructed order by order. And after you do that, you order by order, you look at the energy momentum tensor and you get the result that they have. So this is how you can implement this concretely. And at some point, we thought of doing this also numerically and went only to second order, but okay, numerically, we were not yet able to do very much. So what happens with our shock waves? Well, the shock wave, as I said, in hydrodynamics, we have a jump. The velocity is supersonic and then subsonic. And when you include the microscopics, you will have a smooth change like this. And this should be derived from gravity. Now, unfortunately, we should solve the Einstein equations exactly to find this profile, and either exactly analytically, which I doubt is doable, and numerically, which is very hard. So we are thinking about doing that. So let me tell you what we did. So what we did is first to consider the case where the shock is weak. So if this difference in these velocities above the speed of sound and below is small, the viscosity is enough to smoothen the wave. So actually, although I was saying that that's not true, if you include higher order coefficients, you can find a smooth wave, a wave that can be described in hydrodynamics for weak shocks. And in the non-relativistic case, in the Navier-Stokes case, this is known as the Berger's equation. The Berger's equation is an approximation that gives you this shock. Yes, so
I mean, you're making the gradient small by making the amplitude small.
Yes. So they have to jump from here to here, and if I make this small, it turns out that the gradient becomes small.
So, Martin, could you tell me what is that you construct? How do you construct this? So, you are on the gravity side and you're looking for a solution?
Well, in this case, we can do both. So, to be concrete, what we did, we found. We have this energy momentum tensor with all these terms up to second order, and we found the shock wave solution here for the energy in the fluid dynamics with the viscosity and this term. And with that, we can.
So you just look for a configuration of U and T that solves.
Yes, so the equations of motion for T mu nu up to here. And as Roberto was saying also this morning, if you take that and you put it here, you have immediately the dual metric up to epsilon cube, I think.
So what type, is it like a plane fronted shockwave, or what type?
Yes, a plane. I'm going to show you now. Yes. So I'm just saying what we did, and then I'm going to show it.
Exactly. You're resolving the shock, right?
We are resolving the shock for a weak shock.
It is?
Yes.
From the perspective of
gravity, you fix that profile on the boundary?
No, that is a solution of some equation.
Okay. It's not very shocky. Look at
that. Well, it's
a, in the sense that the gradients are very big.
Yes, well, it's a shock wave, but it's a... Yeah, for
wave.
It's a shock wave in
it's
the sense that it's
a
supersonic perturbation. Yeah, it's a supersonic perturbation that moves in the fluid, but since it's moving not much faster than the speed of sound, the gradients are small. Yeah.
But if you let it kept going, it would be slow, but at some point it would lose.
No, these are they don't change, so the shape is fixed.
It's stationary.
It's stationary solution. Yeah, these are stationary.
But this is
so the viscosity. Right? It takes that.
Yeah, so the viscosity is taking energy, but the nonlinearity is sort of building up. So it's like a soliton
exactly
in some way. Yeah.
So you're including viscosity terms, and yet this is not dissipated away.
Yeah.
Well, it's dissipating in the sense that the kinetic energy is being converted into heat, but the solution is a stationary solution.
So this will be
feeding
forever.
It with energy.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but because I'm throwing
here,
yes. So this is the same situation
so
here.
Have a solid on that. Yeah.
But is it unstable?
No, I don't think it's. No, I think it's stable. So
I think the
it is this shock. This shock is also stationary. This is stationary. This is stationary here.
So are you injecting
and with
viscosity? You're injecting energy because when you solve the hydro equations, you're fixing that the velocity over here and over here are different, right? So this is injecting energy into the system.
Yes. So you're injecting from infinity.
You're injecting the energy to stay in the inertial regime. That's how you manage to keep that profile.
Yes. So if the fluid is at rest, this will be moving at this velocity against the fluid at rest. Now for a strong shock, so this is much larger, it's larger compared to the speed of sound, so there is a large jump. As I said, we cannot find the exact solution, but what we can find is the solution here. So the solution here, you can see that it's an exponentially decaying solution here and here, and we can find the exponential decay for any amplitude of the shock. For weak shock, that agrees with what I was saying before, but for large shocks, we can compute this. We cannot compute the exact matching of how the two exponentials match in the middle. And why we can do that? Well, the reason we can do that is because here you have the solution is a black hole moving with some velocity and here with some other velocity. But here this shock is just a small perturbation of the motion of the fluid. So you can solve it using a linearized gravity, which still requires some numerical work, but it's just solving a linear differential equation.
So you're not solving the fluid equations in that region?
So if you want, we are doing two things. From here, we are using fluid mechanics for weak shocks to find the profile and reconstruct gravity. For strong shocks, we are using gravity to find the exponential decay. Because this exponential decay is a very small perturbation, but the gradients are large. So if the derivative is large compared to the function, but the function in itself is small. So you have to use a microscopic description even to find this profile. So this exponential profile is just the penetration depth of the perturbation into the plasma. And this penetration depth follow from a microscopic description.
How can you solve it just in that? I mean, isn't this boundary value problem solving it in only one region?
No. Okay. Well, we just put that this case exponential in that direction. So you get e to the qx and minus qx,
okay.
And you just keep e to the minus q. But it doesn't really matter. The q has the same mode.
How does the temperature vary as a function of x?
Well, it's here is much smaller than here, so all the kinetic energy that the fluid is bringing is converted into heat.
Is it fair to say that you have an horizon with a varying temperature?
Well, yeah, I think that's what we have. And,
okay, so it's like a flame funnel. Okay, no,
which is a bit strange because it's a stationary solution, and I'm going to discuss this a little bit later.
But there's a heat flow.
Yes, there is a flow.
Wasn't there a constant surface gravity there? Isn't there a theorem that says if you have a stationary solution?
No, because it's non-compact, the space, so no.
But that doesn't require to be compact.
It does.
It's
also a killing, this is
it's
not,
not
a killing horizon.
Yeah.
It's only an horizon, it's not killing.
Oh, so the killing vector.
It's not the killing vector.
I'm happy that I'm getting support, because usually I get the idea that it's not possible.
Why do you think usually people complain when the horizon has a varying difference.
Why do you think the solution is
safe? Well, because we analyze it, but I'm going to discuss the perturbations later. Okay, so how do you describe, so let me start by the weak shock. So the weak shock, as I said, we found this solution in hydrodynamics. So
sorry to interrupt you, but I guess one very simple limit of this solution would be one in which all the velocities are zero, but you fix different temperatures over here, and then you would just have a heat flow, right?
Well, that is a, it's not a limit of this, but it's a possible scenario. I don't think...
I cannot take the velocities to zero and keep the temperature.
Yeah, you can.
No, one velocity has to be larger than the speed of sound, and the other has to be
that's
smaller.
His solution, but that's
not. Okay, yeah, sorry.
Okay, so how do we, so as I said, in the weak case, we did in the we solved this, we found this profile using hydrodynamics. So let's see how that lands. So we start from the ideal hydro, and this is in lambda on Lifshitz in just a small exercise, I think, as always. So in the ideal hydro, you have just this part of the energy momentum tensor, and you have a flow of energy and a flow of momentum. And the condition is that across the interface, the energy and the momentum are conserved, so the flow of energy here and here have to be the same. So these tensors have to be the same here, and also this. And if you have charge or number of particles, they also should be conserved, but this is not the case here. So you write this, and you say that this... So if you plot it, for example, I don't know if you see this plot, but there is a plot of, I don't know, the ratio of these two, for example, as a function of, because if you take the ratio, the pressure goes away, so you have the velocity. And you see that the same value can be obtained for two different velocities, one above the speed of sound and the other smaller. So you find a very precise relation between the two velocities. So the product of the velocity has to be the velocity of sound squared, which here is 1 over square root of 3. So one has always to be supersonic and the other subsonic. And you find a relation between the pressures and the temperatures also. And that means that if you fix the velocity and the temperature here, this is completely fixed. So you cannot match anything. So anything you want. So you have to have this precise relation. Now, there is a generation of entropy, as I said already several times, and one way, simple way to see it is to construct an entropy current, which has the entropy density times the velocity, and you can see that there is more entropy going out here than is going in there. And so the flow of entropy doesn't match, and the difference is given by some quantity that tells you how much entropy is being generated. And if you go to the higher order hydrodynamics, what I was saying, you start from a solution which is just so the U, remember the relation between U and V is this relativistic relation. So if V is 1 square over square root of 3, U is 1 over square root of 2. So this is the speed of sound. So we said the solution initially is just the speed of sound, and then you add a small perturbation, and that you expand in powers of, for example, this U infinity, which is the value of the velocity at infinity above the speed of sound. And you see that there is a simple solution for first order hydrodynamics, which is a hyperbolic tangent. So it looks exactly like a soliton in some way. And this x, well, this psi is x rescaled, so it's a dimension. And then at a higher, and this is the same as I think the Berger's equation for the from non-relativistic also gives some solution like this. And at higher order, the next order correction is some function that actually, okay, if you plot it, it still looks like a hyperbolic tangent. So it's a small correction because, okay, you want it to be small, otherwise the expansion is not valid. So, but the main idea is that essentially you find the profile as a hyperbolic tangent. So this is the profile of the shock, and you can keep correcting it at higher orders if you wish. And you can also find the temperature profile. And as I was saying before, you could put this into the expression for the metric and find the dual metric to this shock up to second order or third order in derivative. you can discuss again the entropy current, and if you include the viscosity, Logan and Yagam derive this expression for the viscosity based from gravity, and essentially you see that the divergence, sorry, the entropy current, the divergence of the entropy current is not zero, it depends proportional to the viscosity term, and one can compute where this is. So the entropy generation is always the same, because asymptotically the expressions are okay. But the only thing that this changes is to say where the entropy is generated. So you know it's generated at the shock, but now that you resolve the shock, you can see that the entropy is being generated precisely at the shock. If you go to higher order hydro, you see that it's slightly more on the supersonic side. But so that gives you a description of how the... So once you resolve the shock, you can start computing some stuff. And the gravity dual, as I said, you can write it, and it doesn't, yeah, it's very small, I guess you cannot read, but it's not the purpose of knowing what the metric is, it's just to show that this Bhattacharya, Khomeini, Mingguan, and Rangamani give you a precise way to, given the hydro solution, how to construct the non-singular metric, which is non-singular in the this infalling coordinates. And these Fs are the solutions to this linear differential equation that I was saying before. I've written there. Okay, so now let's go to the case of a strong shock, where I said we can compute the exponential decay at infinity, although we cannot see how these exponentials match in the middle. And the reason we can do that is that at infinity, well, far from the shock, it's not too far because I say this is exponential. So you have that the velocity of the fluid here, plus some small correction, and as long as this is small, we can use linearized gravity. But as I said, we cannot use hydrodynamics because the derivatives are not small. So in other ways, the perturbation in gravity will be the boosted black hole. So you have a boosted black hole here and a boosted black hole here with different velocities and temperatures. So we don't know how to match those two metrics. But here we know that the metric is a boosted black hole plus a correction, and this correction we can write as a wave with some frequency and some momentum, and we are interested in zero frequency and imaginary momentum, and that will give you the exponential decay. And we need to solve the Einstein equation for this at the linearized approximation. And it was, we need to put some boundary conditions in the radial direction.
Sorry,
yes.
How did you know it was exponential?
And
what was this?
X is this.
I see. So you put an I in there, but you mean real
X. Q is imaginary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so this is a generic wave.
I see. But why is it, you're saying it's separable just because of the translation invariance in that region?
Yes, in this region, where I just put this metric, which is translation invariant, plus a fluctuation, and this fluctuation has some non-trivial R and has trivial. Well, this you can put Y and Z, but I'm not interested in those at the moment.
But how do you know it couldn't have a power law tail? Why does it have to be exponential? I'm quite sure I understand. I understand if you're in a homogeneous background because of translation variance, you can separate and get exponential behavior, but I'm not sure.
But isn't this guaranteed to be a quasi normal one?
Yeah, these are the. I mean, I can answer that. That's what we found. So we found that this solves the equation.
It's
but I don't know if there is a way to argue directly.
It's a linear perturbation around a black brain. Yeah.
But I guess what I'm saying is the actual solution. You could construct the whole thing in linear theory, not just the asymptotics, and then that. It's not obvious to me that would have a separable form.
Depend on R and there is a superposition of many exponentials. So we only compute the one that decays slowest.
But when you have a superposition of, there might be a continuous
superposition
of an infinite number of exponentials isn't necessarily exponential.
No, but if you allow me to give indirect evidence, here you have also, in this case, exponential behavior. We already see it in this case, for example, in the case where we can find the whole solution.
Maybe you
can say, okay, when the shock is strong, maybe that's not true anymore.
Yeah.
But
maybe the point is because you've got a temperature, you've got a discrete spectrum.
There is a discrete spectrum. And
that's the lowest. I see. Yeah.
And this is the lowest.
That's
I think, yeah, you should, okay.
No, I see.
And then in the real direction, you use the same idea that in Eddington Finkelstein, in foreign coordinates, the same as Ningwala, Rangamani, Bhattacharya, and Kubeni, that the metric should be non-singular in this Eddington Finkelstein coordinate that translates into this H being non-singular. And the H has different components, but as was shown by, it's a nice paper by Starinets, or maybe it was noticed before, but what they notice is that, or Alex also told me this, that you make some particular linear combination of the components, and this sort of decouples and get an equation by itself. I think Alex maybe noticed it before, I don't know. But and the coefficients are just some polynomials. On U is the radial direction, and gamma is this velocity of the black hole. And I think I normalize the temperature to be 1 here. This is here. Okay, so this is a non-trivial, it's a simple but non-trivial equation because of this polynomial that you can solve numerically and see what the Qs and omega, for omega equals 0, what Q is. So let me give you some, so this we can solve numerically for any value of the velocity, and I'm going to show the result later, but let me give you some ideas. So if the velocity is the speed of sound, we found that the Q is 0, so this is the case of no shock, and you can write analytically the wave function of the metric. Now, there is a curious point which we don't understand physically, which is the velocity square root of 2/3, which we call the singular point because some of the polynomials have a singularity, but the equation is not singular. We can find analytically the value of Q, and also this Z is some hypergeometric, but we don't have any interpretation of that. It just turns out that it's a good check for the numerics, and it would be nice to know why this happens from a physical point of view. But and then the other thing we can check is that if the velocity is 0, one is computing the normal modes essentially of the black hole, and that was done by Mazur and collaborators to study globules in 2+1 dimensions. So we have a circle which is a temperature circle. If you think of that circle as a space-like direction, you are doing a non-supersymmetric compactification because the bosons are periodic and the fermions are anti-periodic. Therefore, for the 2+1 dimensional theory, will be essentially a low energy will reduce to 2+1 superion mils, which is confining, and this will be the mass of the lowest global that was computed by Mazur, and we agree with that result. And the other thing which we can consider a result from our paper is that we looked at the ultra-relativistic limit when the velocity goes to the speed of light. So the shock is moving close to the speed of light, or the fluid is coming at the speed of light. And we saw that there is an interesting scaling of the Q, which will be like the penetration depth of the shock into the fluid, that goes like square root of the gamma factor. So this is the gamma factor, which is going to infinity. So Q goes to infinity, and the penetration length goes to 0. So we found this interesting exponent here, 1/2, that we checked should be valid for any asymptotical ADS dynamics, and for other dimensions, is 2 over the dimension. So there is some sort of exponent there that we compute. And it will be interesting also to see how it behaves, let's say, for QCD or something, like, which shouldn't be just a scaling. But. In this limit, where the fluid becomes ultra-relativistic, the profile H of R, the wave in the radial direction, approaches also a fixed value, which is a solution of this simpler equation that you still have to solve numerically, but solving this equation gives this number in front. But the scaling is analytic, so you can see that. Okay, so numerically here we have the Q as a function of gamma, and as I was saying, or you were discussing also here, there are several Qs. And we just choose the lowest mode, which corresponds, if you go to real Qs, to the sound mode. So we can think of this as the analytic continuation of the sound. This is the speed of sound, and this is the hydrodynamic region. So this can be sort of the analytic continuation of sound. But then when you go far away, you are far away from the NA. So Q becomes large. Q is a derivative, so the derivatives are large. And you can see that they grow like square root of gamma. And all this is a numerical. And then there is a whole spectrum of Qs, which comes essentially because there is a fifth dimension, and the H can depend on R in different ways. And okay, that's not the only, usually you also have several exponentials, but if you were to have this fluid and be very good experimenter and look at that, looking at this spectrum of Qs, one might say, oh, this fluid looks fifth dimensional. I don't know. And if you compare with hydrodynamics, this is the weak shock, so here it agrees. But if you go away from the weak shock, this Q diverges. This is the speed of light now, it's not the gamma factor, it's V, so it goes to infinity. The first order hydro actually goes to zero, and second order hydro also, so qualitatively it's completely wrong. There is another hydrodynamics that I will not discuss in, which is Israel Stewart, which actually you can see that it diverges. So it has the correct, apparently correct behavior for Q at some velocity, which is not the speed of light, but you can also move the parameters so that it's the speed of light. But then I think goes like gamma, not like square root of gamma. So it doesn't have the right behavior.
These are results that you take when you truncate hydrons, you take it away from the regime. So you're seeing things like well, the ghost instabilities of the.
You see the.
And when you truncate the.
Yeah, this is a solution we had before extrapolated to. Yeah. And then.
And do you see why Israel Stewart gives. Is there any way, simple way of understanding why Israel Stewart seems to be capturing things better than.
Well, no, it's not much better. As I said, it diverges at some velocity, which is unrelated to the speed of light.
Okay, so it's just,
and you can move the parameters so that it's the speed of light by hand. But then it will not match here perfectly. So if you match it here, it diverges at some arbitrary velocity, which doesn't seem to be... the speed of light is obviously something dynamical of the system. This seems to be some arbitrary velocity. And it doesn't diverge like square root of gamma anyway. So.
But I think one point of Israel and Stewart's construction is that it was a cause of theory.
Yeah,
right.
Well,
the R one
seems to be.
Yeah, but I wanted to know whether that is something that we
would
see.
And the other thing that might be a curiosity for them is just that there is, I don't know if you see, but there are two curves here. And they separate here a little bit. So one is a numerical result, and the other is a very simple expression, V minus the speed of sound times square root of gamma. So this simple expression approximates very well the whole curve. So it would be good to use it as a way to understand how this curve behaves and might be useful.
How did you get to that expression?
Yeah,
that simple expression.
This? Oh, we just tried. I mean, it has to diverge by square root of gamma and has to be zero at the speed of sound. So we found this.
You
and
found
we,
the four.
Oh, no, no, this you match. No, we match this so that the slope is the right one at the speed of sound. So the speed of sound here, we know exactly how it behaves. So this coefficient, the divergence, that's the divergence at square root of gamma, but not with the right coefficient. Yeah. But okay, it's quite close. Actually. If you see carefully, they are not on top of each other. Okay, so as I said, there is an interesting result, I believe, which is when gamma goes to infinity, Q goes to infinity with some specific power of gamma. So we investigated what happens in other dimensions. And in other dimensions, it turns out to go like 2 over D. So D4 is 1/2. So it's one looks like a sort of it's critical, well, not the critical exponent, but something like that, the dimension of some operator. But we couldn't understand this in... I mean, it follows from the equations, but we couldn't understand this as a dimension of something. I don't know how this. We don't have a simple derivation of this exponent. Once you have the equation, it's easy to see that this is the correct scaling. But without the equation, I don't know. And in QCD, one might expect maybe some logs here of gamma. I don't know. That'd be interesting. We wanted to look at that, but notice that the QCD is not meaningless because here we are looking at very small distances. So we're looking at Q going to infinity. So it's a principle could be accessible in perturbative QCD. So, then there is this question that was already asked. What happens if you have a stationary solution? The surface gravity should be constant. There is a theorem by Hawking that says that. And I believe the answer is what he already answered, which is that the horizon is non-compact. So let me discuss it first from a qualitative point of view. So the usual idea is that if you have a compact system, and it's moving or something, and it reaches some equilibrium. When it reaches the equilibrium, the temperature is uniform. And that's the only equilibrium that you can have, and only stationary. So stationary has to be equilibrium there. And then for a black hole, you have a compact horizon. The temperature is uniform, and that the surface gravity is uniform. The surface gravity is understood as the temperature, and both things agree. So that's nice. But when you have a non-compact system, you can inject energy from one place and take it from the other. So you can have a situation where you are not at equilibrium, but the situation is stationary. Other way of looking at that is if you have a black hole, for example, and this solution is generating entropy, so it's stationary, but the entropy is increasing, the area should be increasing. So if you have a compact area, a compact horizon has a finite area, and the area is increasing, that can never be stationary. In this case, the area is infinite, so saying that it increases, it doesn't say anything. Another way of saying is that the total entropy in some way is fixed, because entropy is being generated, but it's being removed from here faster than it's injected from there. More formally, so the proof of Hawking proofs with asymptotically flat space, but I don't think that's very important. But on the other hand, in some part of the proof, he has a finite horizon because he shows there is a symmetry, and he has to show that the symmetry of the horizon extends to the whole solution, and you can see that it's a symmetry of the asymptotic flat space. But here, these symmetries, when the horizon is not compact, they will not be symmetries. For example, you will need a translation in X is a symmetry, and it's not, because you are breaking that by the boundary conditions at plus and minus infinite X. For example, if you have a compact horizon, a Schwarzschild black hole, you cannot have a shock wave that is stationary, because the velocity here will be, let's say, suppose it's like a circle. Here the velocity is larger, and here it's smaller, but where is it coming from? You will need like two shocks, but you can't have two shocks because it always goes from supersonic to subsonic. So you could have a shock that propagates in the horizon, but not stationary. Something we didn't do is to discuss this numerically. So I said I wasn't going to go over time, but I guess I'm doing it.
Yeah, so let me ask you again, sir, about the
stability. Now, for example, this is the stability. So now one problem about the stability, for example, is what happens if the shock starts to oscillate. So you have to compute the modes of oscillation and see if you have a thing that grows or not. And typically what happens is that this can oscillate, but doesn't grow. That's what happens in the usual shock waves, and the same that happens here. But this oscillation can persist if their wavelength is large, so they are not so much damped by the viscosity, and they generate some. And that's why you hear, I believe, some of the. So when you have a shock wave like an airplane, any turbulence or anything that produces sound is amplified by the shock, and that's why you hear the sound, the strong sound. But,
so excuse me, yeah. If you have a big difference in temperature, are you not expecting compactive instabilities due to the difference in temperature or something like that?
If you expect compactive
instabilities, if you break more symmetry.
But for this particular shock, you mean? I'm just looking at this shock.
Right, but break the translation symmetry along one other direction.
Yeah, I do a small oscillation, and I compute the modes of oscillation, and I see if there is a negative or not. So I do this calculation.
But even if the temperature is very, very large.
But here, from here to here?
Yeah, very
no,
large.
No, from here to here is constant. But from here to here, what do you mean? A very large amplitude.
The temperature difference. The temperature
from
difference
here to here.
Yeah.
Yes. No. Well, because here is much larger, but the fluid is moving in that way. I don't know. It's essentially these perturbations are carried very fast into the subsonic side. They cannot propagate into supersonic. So I mean, this is a calculation that gives the. So let me briefly say what the calculation gives and. So when it oscillates, well, this is a bit of exaggeration, but it oscillates very little. You have a normal, and you just match the normal component of the energy momentum tensor, and I'm just doing it for the ideal fluid. That's enough. One can see what types of perturbation you can have. This will not cannot create perturbations. They propagate at the speed of sound at most, so they cannot go into there. So they cannot move on in this direction. And here you have two types of waves. One are sound waves. The other are called shear waves. A shear wave is simply that for the ideal fluid, any if the velocity is in y, sorry, is in x and depends only on y, you can put an arbitrary profile and it will always be a solution. And if you boost it, that's called a shear wave. And has some properties, and then the sound wave that propagates with this speed is also have some relation for the amplitudes. And finally, you need to match the energy momentum tensor on both sides, and you see that there are six quantities, the velocity of the shear wave, the velocity of the sound wave, the variation in temperature and the oscillations, and you can count and you have six equations. So the solution is homogeneous, so it's zero unless there is an eigenvalue condition. And the eigenvalue condition gives you a relation between the momentum and the frequency. And curiously, if you compute the ratio of the momentum kx with ky, it's fixed. So it doesn't depend on omega because the omega cancels. And that means that the direction of the sound waves that are emerging from here is determined. So the sound waves are only propagating in a particular cone that depends on the velocity of the shock. And actually, there are two cones because there are two solutions here. And this is something, I don't know, I didn't find it. Maybe this is already known, I don't know. Because this, as I said, this is a relativistic fluid with ideal hydrodynamics. So we didn't do anything, gravity or anything. We just analyzed a little bit further the relativistic shock wave. So this is done in London-Lifshitz for the non-relativistic case. And we did the relativistic case. I don't know if somebody did it or not, but we didn't find it. And the result, I don't think this is, I don't remember what happens in the non-relativistic case. I think this is for the relativistic that the angle is fixed. Okay, so, oops. Well, I have the last slide. Well, and they are okay, and we didn't find any imaginary, that's why we say stable.
So, you got an eddy, why wouldn't you excite any turbulence? So, you are in the turbulence.
Oh, no, the turbulence is when you have shear. So, this is when you have.
But I could introduce a perturbation.
Ah, well, but this has to be very small. So, because this is a linearized. Okay, you can be unstable under large perturbation, but this is just linearized analysis. We only do say that it's stable under linearized. Perturbation.
But I could imagine putting something at the linear order.
Well, we put anything you can put at the linear order. So this is the most general perturbation that you can have that solves all the equations. So and so there is nothing more. And it's not obvious that this should be stable. So it could be that it's not. But you find that there are some modes that have no imaginary part. That means that they last for a while and they create this sound taking energy from the fluid. And viscosity will dampen this, so the viscosity will tell you that only very long wavelengths will survive. Okay, so we did a systematic study of the shocks in ADS-CFT as far as we could do it for the plasma in equal 4, and we learned something about gravity from fluid mechanics for the weak shocks. So we learned something non-trivial, which is that there are stationary solutions for black holes. We have horizons which depend, the temperature depends on the position. And we were able to reconstruct these gravity solutions up to this order. Now one can say, okay, maybe if you go to the full order, there is something singular. Okay, that I don't know. But as far as we could see, these solutions are there. Then we learned something about the fluid mechanics from the gravity side. So looking at the microscopic description, if you wish, for the fluid point of, from the fluid point of view, which is that this the penetration depth scales like gamma to the minus 1/2 when gamma becomes ultra-relativistic. And in general, we believe so these shock waves are a way which is partially hydrodynamics, but also probes the microscopic of the theory. So the only way to resolve the shock is to look at the microscopic. So they should be more carefully studied in different settings. So one thing I want to say is that these shocks, we are not saying that they are shocks in gravity. So they are not gravitational shocks. There are some waves that propagate supersonically in the horizon of the black hole. Okay, so that's all I have to say.